It is 8:30. We have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish, co-editor at Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Tons to cover, so...
Yeah, I feel great this morning. I was hanging out in bars last night in Portland.
Okay. Oh, good. Yeah, we can smell it from here.
We had a great drive coming back.
All right. Well, speaking of which...
Yes.
The State Department of Transportation...
Yeah, there was a lot of transportation stuff this week. The State Department of Transportation issued a ruling which had been anticipated for a while. In fact, I think I've talked about it on this show before. The city had asked them, they were starting to seriously consider, as part of the November ballot measure for what to do about the Alaskan Way Viaduct, the option of not rebuilding the viaduct and not building a tunnel. In other words, using a waterfront boulevard similar to what they did with the Embarcadero Freeway in San Francisco after the 1989 earthquake there. Peter Steinbrück has been pushing that option. My friends at The Stranger have been pushing it very hard. And it has some real advantages. The only problem is that it is doing that, which essentially is doing nothing other than tearing down the current viaduct and then, you know, widening Alaska Way and doing some landscaping, would actually cost more to city taxpayers than either building a tunnel or a new viaduct. And the reason for that is that the $2 billion that the state legislature appropriated is conditional upon it continuing to be a state highway, SR-99, as is Aurora Boulevard to the north and the route to the south of downtown also, which the Alaska Way Viaduct connects. Now, the problem with the Waterfront Boulevard is that it would divert so much other traffic. You know, it can't hold enough traffic. So the idea was, well, you know, other traffic will be diverted to I-5, to the arterial grid downtown, et cetera. When you do that, the Waterfront Boulevard itself would fall below the minimum carrying capacity that is necessary to designate something as a state highway, and therefore the state funding drops out. So we would have to, we as citizens, taxpayers in the city of Seattle, for those folks who live in Seattle, would have to pay all of the costs of tearing down the viaduct, of, you know, widening Alaska Way, et cetera, rather than having the first $2 billion of either the viaduct or the tunnel picked up by the state. So in all likelihood, the city council, with that information, will probably not put a no-build option on the ballot in November. But even if they do, it's now going to be the most expensive option rather than the least expensive, which is, you know, totally counterintuitive. But that's what the state ruled this week.
Okay. And Ron Sims is proposing a tax increase for buses.
Yeah, this is actually way, way overdue. And even though it is a sales tax and regressive, it's Sims is proposing 0.1 cents additional sales tax in King County. And unfortunately, because of the way the state tax structure is structured, unless you get real tax reform for the state of Washington, he doesn't have many options for what he can use to raise the money that is desperately needed to expand Metro, to expand the bus system. The last time that the sales tax was raised for this purpose was 0.2 cents, but that was after one of Iman's initiatives I think it was the original $30 tab initiative that cut all the funding for MVET that was being used in part to finance public transit systems around the state. So they needed to make up funding that had already existed. This is the first actual expansion of the routes in a long, long time. King County, particularly the areas outside the city of Seattle, has exploded in population over the last 20 or 30 years. The bus system needs to catch up with it. Particularly critics of light rail, Sound Transit, and of the Seattle Monorail Project have been saying for years, you know, we're spending an enormous amount of money on these light rail or monorail technologies compared to the number of cars it's actually going to take off the road. Whereas if you invested the same amount of money or even a lesser amount of money into expanded public transit, better bus service system, more frequent routes, routes that connected different parts of the country or a county that, you know, went cross town, etc., you would actually do a lot more toward that goal. Well, this is what Sims is trying to do. And it really is a valuable thing. And it's particularly risky to, it'll probably be on the ballot in November. And at the same time, the Regional Transportation Improvement District is expected to have a three-county package of probably tax increases to cover the costs of highway improvements, things like expanded 405 and 520 Bridge and some of the other major highway projects we've talked about. Having both of those on the ballot at the same time is going to be a little messy in terms of what the voters are willing to approve, but this really is a valuable proposal, and Sims deserves some credit for rolling it out.
All right. And it looks like Sound Transit is looking at a new arrival point at the University of Washington.
Yeah, the Finance Committee of Sound Transit's board, which is actually the sort of key decision-making body, because it's always been a question with Sound Transit whether the money is there rather than whether they wanted to actually build it or not. They approved this week an expansion of the already approved and under construction light rail that goes all the way up Rainier Valley and today downtown and then up to Capitol Hill. They approved an extension of it from Capitol Hill to the U District. It'll go underneath the Montlake Cut to Husky Stadium and then underneath the UW campus, and there will be another station probably at 45th and Brooklyn. That site hasn't been decided upon yet, but that's probably the most likely place for it. So it looks like that is going to happen, and they'll probably start, construction on it in a few years once they get all the design stuff settled. And I'm sure there'll be lots of public process for that, too.
All right. And the monorail tax, the much-loved monorail tax.
Yes, which I've got to pay next month. I'm kind of irritated about this because the Seattle Monorail Project, in the process of disbanding, decided that it will not need that tax after June 30th. So if your car is up for renewal anytime after June 30th this year, you're not going to have to pay that tax, which runs well over $100 for almost everyone, and quite a bit more for newer cars that are more expensive. So that's actually some good news for Seattle residents.
All right. Let's jump to national. We can always jump back to local at the end if you
sure.
got some time. Okay. CIA apparently had sent a report dealing with the Niger uranium cakes.
Yes, and this happened 16 days before the 2003 State of the Union address with the infamous 16 words from President Bush talking about how Sodom, I think he always called him Sodom, just like his dad, was trying to seek uranium from Africa for the purpose of building nuclear weapons. Well, it had already been known that there were serious doubts within the State Department and the CIA as to the authenticity of this claim, but it turns out that the State Department had, by this point, already identified the documents that it had been based upon as forgeries. We already knew that the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, had identified them in March, a couple months later, as crude forgeries. But we now know that the State Department had it figured out also, and that they knew, and the CIA knew, and presumably also because it was considered key to the case for invading Iraq, that the White House knew that these were forgeries, and Bush went ahead and his speechwriters went ahead and made the claim anyway in the 2003 State of the Union address. So this is just one more piece of evidence that it wasn't just that the president was cherry-picking intelligence that he liked and Cheney was doing the same thing. They were orchestrating a campaign knowingly based upon lies, that Bush was lying, Cheney was lying, Rice was lying, Powell was lying, all of them, in order to stampede the country into war, and they succeeded.
All right. And General Jeffrey Miller apparently is going to have some explaining to do.
Yeah, Jeffrey Miller, for folks who haven't been following it closely, is the link between Guantanamo Bay and Abu Ghraib. He was the base commander at Guantanamo that was in charge of interrogation of prisoners there, and then he was sent by Donald Rumsfeld to Abu Ghraib to, quote-unquote, gitmoize the interrogation process at Abu Ghraib, which he then did a spectacular job of. He has never actually actually been forced to testify as to his role in any of the various scandals and prosecutions at Abu Ghraib, and that's he's been asked to testify, but he's invoked his right to refuse to self-incriminate, and that's important because without that, the White House and the Pentagon have been able to portray these cases as the quote unquote a few bad apples because there's been no testimony that has actually come out and said, well, these interrogations were part of a specific policy that came down from on high. It came down from General Miller. It came down from Donald Rumsfeld, because Miller's never been asked under oath what his role in this was, how much of it he knew about, how much of it he ordered, and on whose authority he ordered it. Now there's a case, one of the last cases actually that's being prosecuted, of the dog handler at Abu Ghraib. And he's being prosecuted, and of course this is, you know, just another sort of ordinary grunt. But his defense attorneys have succeeded in doing what the prosecutors have been refusing to do. The government doesn't want any of these muckety-mucks testifying because, of course, they have to answer to the same muckety-mucks. But the defense attorneys finally succeeded where past defense attorneys have failed in convincing a judge that Miller should testify. And if he does testify, he's going to be asked only about the dog handling case, and, you know, whose idea was it to use dogs on prisoners, etc. But there's a fair amount of evidence that Rumsfeld himself approved the use of dogs, certainly at Guantanamo Bay, probably at Abu Ghraib as well. And it may be the first opportunity in a trial to link Rumsfeld with all of this. So in addition to all of the retired generals speaking out and calling for his resignation, Rumsfeld may have some legal problems right now, because this may be the first opportunity in a court to actually link him to policies of torture involving the United States.
All right. Well, we were going to cover it last week, but we ran out of time. The White House apparently liked to reach out and touch someone.
Yes. This is kind of a fascinating case that has not gotten a lot of publicity. There have been several Republican operatives, three of them and then a fourth that's under prosecution right now, but three that have already pled guilty and are serving time, basically, for an election scandal in 2002 in New Hampshire. And what this was a scheme by the Republicans to jam the phones of the Senate Get Out the Vote campaign so that, you know, all of the different volunteers who call people to remind them to vote and who offer rides to little old ladies to get them to polling places and all of the things that both Democrats and Republicans do to try and get their base supporters out to the polls to actually poll. This was a very close Senate race involving an incumbent Democrat and then John Sununu, the former Reagan chief of staff who was running for Senate for the Republicans. He was the former governor of New Hampshire at that point. Very close race. The Republicans succeeded in jamming the phones of the Democrats, and the Republicans won that race very narrowly. It's one of the pickups in 2002 that they had in the Senate. Well, it turns out that, of course, this is blatantly illegal, and the top guy for Republican election stuff in New England was a guy named James Tobin has been convicted in conjunction with this scheme. Well, it turns out that on election day, Mr. Tobin, while he's in the process of carrying out this phone jamming thing from New Hampshire, he's in New Hampshire doing this, there were dozens upon dozens of calls placed to the White House policy office, Karl Rove's office, between Tobin and somebody the White House won't say who was actually at that phone number at that time, but somebody in the White House was actually coordinating this campaign. We don't know what Karl Rove knew about this. We don't know who behind in the White House was actually involved in this, but this is a criminal conspiracy that resulted in a Republican being elected to the U.S. Senate, and the White House is up to it in its neck, and to its neck, and it really hasn't gotten very much attention. It's kind of remarkable. Mm-hmm.
All right, moving along, the House Ethics Committee. It looks like they're going to be doing some musical chairs.
Yeah. Well, the House Ethics Committee hasn't been hasn't actually met ever since Tom DeLay took the guy who was chairing it, who had this was in 2004 that the House Ethics Committee had reprimanded DeLay three separate times for different ethics violations, even with a Republican chairperson. Well, DeLay didn't like this, so he found a stooge, and the stooge was Doc Hastings of Eastern Washington, who has been the chair since early 2005. And the House Ethics Committee, despite the Abramoff scandal, despite Duke Cunningham, despite all the different corruption cases that have been going on in the House, has not even met. You go to Doc Hastings' website, and there's not even any mention that he actually chairs this committee. It's remarkable. It's like they disbanded the committee. But it does still exist. And the top-ranking Democrat on the committee is a Democrat from West Virginia. His name, his name is Alan Mulahan. And he is one of the only Democrats in the country. He's from West Virginia. He's only one of the only Democrats in the country in the House who's in serious re-election trouble. And he's in re-election trouble because of an ethics scandal that this week forced him to actually resign his post on the House Ethics Committee. He's getting a lot of pressure back home. And the reason he's getting a lot of pressure back home is yeah, it's a pretty good reason. Over the last decade, he's used his post on the Appropriations Committee to funnel approximately $250 million in government funds to five different nonprofit agencies that he set up. It seems pretty egregious. But what this means is that when the Democrats talk about taking back the House, we've heard, incessantly that, you know, it's going to be 15 seats that are necessary. In fact, one of the top Democrats in the country in the House, came to fundraise for Darcy Burner last week. He was talking about, you know, this district is 1/15th of what the country needs to take back the House. Well, no, it's not. It's 1/16th because this Mulahan is in real danger and likelihood of losing his seat to a Republican this November. And what this unfolding ethics scandal means is it's going to be that much more difficult with all the gerrymandered House districts in the country and so few races actually in play. It's actually going to be that much more difficult for the Democrats to take back the House. So people need to be aware of this case.
All right, moving along. The architect, Karl Rove, appears to be moving on to other duties.
Yes, and this was widely, when it happened on Wednesday, the same day, incidentally, that Patrick Fitzgerald's grand jury heard testimony against Rove in conjunction with Valerie Plamegate. So Rove is not out of the legal woods by any stretch, but this was widely seen as a demotion. He, in addition to being the president's chief policy, political advisor, he had taken on the role for the past year or so of being the chief policy advisor. Well, then practice this hasn't meant very much because Bush hasn't had very many policies. He certainly hasn't had many policies that succeeded in getting much traction in Congress. But and he's probably wasn't going to for the rest of the year because what the Republicans are really focused on right now is a desperate struggle to keep control of both the Senate and the House in November because they know, and the White House especially knows, that if the Democrats take over either chamber of Congress, they'll have subpoena power, they'll be able to launch investigations, and Bush will not be able to do anything for the next 2 years except hire and spend a lot of money on lawyers. So by giving up this role, it's not a demotion. It means that Karl Rove is going to spend full time for the rest of the year doing nothing but coordinating the campaign that will attempt to keep the Republicans in power in the House and the Senate. He won't have any other duties to distract him from that because the Republicans realize that that's the whole ballgame, that the policy questions are really going to be secondary this year for them. They're not even going to try to do anything other than stay in power.
And who's replacing him?
A guy named Joel Kaplan is replacing him. And there's an interesting story about Joel Kaplan, too, it turns out, that has not gotten a lot of media attention this week. Mr. Kaplan, it turns out, was one of the – in fact, he coined this term – was one of the Brooks Brothers rioters. He was one of the people who staged this fake mob that pressured election counters in Florida during the recounts between Gore and Bush in 2000. You may remember that there was this very well-dressed heel of anger angry Republicans that converged, I think it was Palm Beach County, that that really intimidated the election counters there and got a huge amount of publicity. And it was even clear at the time that this was a wholly astroturf operation. This was not spontaneously outraged Florida Republicans. This was a nationally coordinated thing. But it turns out some of the participants in that so-called riot are now well positioned and have nice jobs within the White House. And it turns out one of them now is the chief policy advisor to President Bush. How about that?
Huh. All right. Quickly, the IMF is singling out a specific country this week for some work.
Yeah, the IMF does a global report on the global economy every year and identifies countries that it thinks poses a risk to the global economy. And of course, this is sort of a precursor to imposing structural adjustment programs and all the other prescriptions that are imposed in order to receive international credit. Well, guess who got singled out this week? The United States and the Bush administration for its record trade and federal deficits. And this is even more remarkable because the IMF is controlled not by one country, one vote, as in the UN, but countries get votes depending on the size of their economy. So the United States has dominated the IMF for years. It's one of the chief complaints of the Global South that the U.S. uses the IMF and the World Bank, where it has essentially voting control, in order to impose economic policies on the rest of the world that are favorable to the United States. Well, now the United States is in part of President Bush's ongoing and wildly successful campaign to turn us into a third world country. This is just another benchmark that the IMF is starting to look at the United States economy as a third world economy. And you wonder how long it'll be before the IMF starts telling us to get rid of our remaining social programs. It's just remarkable that our economy has come to this in only 5+ years from having a record trade surplus when Bush took office.
All right, jumping to international, I'd like to start with Iraq since there's multiple things on that.
Yeah, it was a really important week in Iraq. It looks like we have a new unity government finally. The United States has prevailed. Al-Jafari, the previous prime minister, after saying on Wednesday that that stepping aside was out of the question, on Thursday he stepped aside. And it's been the United States in particular that was really pressuring Al-Jafari and the Shiites and the Iraqi government very, very hard to form the kind of quote-unquote national unity government that the U.S. wanted. And, of course, a lot of people in Iraq are very upset about this. I mean, they want a government. There's been no functional government in Iraq. In fact, a lot of the country, there's no government services, there's no security, there's no nothing. But the whole idea that you can have, and Palestinians have discovered this too, that you can have an election, that you can elect whoever you want, and if it displeases the United States, those people will not be able to take office, or the country will be punished if those people do take office. Well, the Shiites in Iraq have discovered this again. They could not go with al-Jafari. But what they have done instead is a new prime minister, a guy named Jawal al-Maliki, who is a very close ally of al-Jafari. He's very conservative, probably a lot of the same policies. You're likely to probably see a new minister in the interior ministry because the United States is pressuring on that also. But the question of whether the Shiite-dominated government of Iraq, even though it's a so-called national unity government, right now the actual government is very much one side in the unfolding civil war because it's the Shiites versus the Sunnis is where a lot of the bloodshed is coming from, and all the security agencies, the interior ministry, the police, the military, are very much dominated by the militias associated with Shiite religious parties, and that probably will not change anytime soon.
All right. And some NGOs had a report this week?
Yes. 125 NGOs came out with a reporting that since January, I mean, this is just remarkable. Since January, 20,000 Iraqis have been kidnapped, including 5,000 women and 2,400 children. No word yet on how many of those people are dead, but you can probably bet with this 5,000 women and 2,400 children that a fair number of them are winding up, say, in Southeast Asia. This is not just sectarian violence, although a lot of it is sectarian violence. A lot of it also is criminal. There's simply no security in Iraq. There's no risk to carrying out criminal activity. So you're getting mob rule. You're getting mafia rule. In addition to the terrorism, in addition to the unfolding civil war, in addition to the insurgency against occupying United States troops, it's no wonder Iraq is such a mess.
All right. And reconstruction scandals?
Yeah. Philip Bloom, a business person, was pleaded guilty this week to conspiracy, bribery, and money laundering charges. This is just a remarkable little story. He spent $2 million bribing United States officials, none of whom have been prosecuted yet, as far as I know. In return, he got $8.6 million in cost-plus contracts with an average 25%+ profit margin. So it was a very profitable investment in bribing U.S. officials for Mr. Bloom. The only problem was he got caught, but probably an awful lot of other business people did not get caught, or at least have not been prosecuted yet. Bloom is one of the first.
All right. Jumping over to Afghanistan, things continue to unravel there.
Yeah, they're very much unraveling. Over 20 civilians were killed in a three-day period, and later this week, a rocket was actually fired in Kabul, which is sort of one of the last peaceful places in Afghanistan. Rocket was fired on the U.S. embassy, actually missed and hit the courtyard of state television next door. But it tells you that not only is much of the country not under control, not even of the Afghanistan government that's, you know, was basically put in place by the United States, but not even the associated warlords that the U.S. has been paying off in order to, you know, grow their poppy and ship heroin to Western Europe and the United States for the last several years. The country is, more and more of the country is falling under the control of the Taliban and associated religious parties, and we're gonna have chaos in Afghanistan, just like we had this steadily growing insurgency for the last several years in Iraq. Afghanistan is becoming just as much of a problem.
All right, and developments in Iran this week.
Yeah, some really important ones. There's a report this morning, at least according to the Iranian envoy to the International Atomic Energy Agency, that Iran in principle anyway, has reached an agreement with Russia to go in for a joint venture for uranium enrichment that would be done on Russian soil. The question at this point is whether Iran would be doing that in addition to, or in place of, doing it on Iranian soil, which is the key demand of Europe and the United States, is that they stop doing that. If it's instead of, this could actually defuse the crisis. It would probably be to the great disappointment of the White House. But since the United States is refusing to negotiate with Iran, and in fact, there was a fascinating report from Lawrence Wilkerson, the former Powell chief of staff this week, that the neocons surrounding Bush actually stopped the United States from negotiating on nuclear issues with Iran in 2002-2003. They wanted to keep it off the table so that they could use the nuclear issue against Iran later on, and of course, we're seeing exactly that. That's what's happening. Diplomacy may have succeeded in this case, despite the strongest efforts of the United States to make sure that it not succeed. That's the significance of this morning's report.
All right. Unfortunately, we don't really have much time to be able to jump in on anything else. Talking once again with Job Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State, and where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State's a volunteer publication that comes out every couple of weeks, a free newspaper that you can get around town where you get free newspapers, cafes, coffee shops, the King County Library System, various other places. It's also available on the web at www.eatthestate.org, including all of our back issues and appeals for money and volunteers and all the rest of it. And we're having a fundraiser a week from tomorrow. David Barsamian will be in town that weekend, and he's going to talk for us at University Baptist Church at 7 o'clock on Sunday evening, the 30th. We're treating it as part of our 10th anniversary party. So folks can come help, help out the paper, $5 to $15 sliding scale or whatever you can donate, and come hear David and hang out with a bunch of alternative media junkies. So come join us Sunday night, the 30th, University Baptist Church.
All right. Well, it's Alternative Radio's 20th anniversary, so you
yes,
both
it is.
Crack
it
open
and
a bottle.
And he started out literally doing a program like this one on KGNU in Boulder, and it just grew and grew and grew, and he's just done a remarkable job with it.